storm has caused confusion and delay.
You have caused
confusion and delay.
I think you are face prejudice.
Daisy is just the ultimate thought. Daisy is just the ultimate thought.
Your impatience has caused confusion and delay. This storm has caused confusion and delay. You are causing confusion and delay. You cause confusion and delay.
26 years old and you can't even drive? I can. Are you stupid, eh? Are you a stupid fool? Well, why can't you drive then? You can't even drive! Bit grey today.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to Another Deepest Lore. I'm here at a bit of a later time. I've decided to experiment because I was disappointed with the first episode viewing numbers, as everybody knows. So I've moved the show from Cigar Stream, the Adam Curtis review series from Cigar Stream, to The Deepest Lore, which is a little bit like moving it from BBC Two to BBC Four. But I've pushed the time later so that more people can have a chance to watch it. And I've also decided, a lot of people said that Americans don't know who Adam Curtis is, and so the title wasn't kind of grabbing. So I've changed the title to something that, you know, may entice more people to give things a watch, considering how interesting the subject matter is. So I'm experimenting with not putting the names of the Curtis documentaries in the show title, but rather what it is about. Okay. I've just noticed that I've left an L out of Churchill, so let me add that in right now. Just if you don't know what I've been doing here and you missed the first episode, you could go back and watch it. I am reviewing every single Adam Curtis documentary, starting at the very beginning of his career in 1988. And it starts with a show called An Ocean Apart, which is presented by David Dimbleby. There's actually a book that accompanied the series, which I've now bought. I haven't read it yet, but it was co-written by the presenter, David Dimbleby, and the historian, David Reynolds, who I suspect wrote the script for this as well, judging by what it says in the book. And Adam Curtis is the producer and very obviously, I think, edited the show together, because even though it's not got the signature Curtis style, there's enough of the Curtis style in the way it's edited to, you know this is an Adam Curtis movie or TV series. Just before we get going, and Oceans Apart, the series is about how Britain and America, do have an ocean apart, two quite different countries. Certainly they were before the First World War started. And it's basically tracing the journey of how America came to supplant Britain as the world hegemon, and how Britain over time got Americanized, if you want to put it that way, which is a subject, as anybody who watches this channel knows, quite close to my heart, something that I, how can I put this? I mean, it's something that I have a bit of a love-hate relationship with. I hate the fact that this has happened. But also, as anybody who knows me knows, I grew up in Thatcher's Britain. I grew up in the 80s, and I'm literally a child of this. So it in many ways, I am an almost like totally Americanized person, if that makes any sense, by which I mean, you know, when I was growing up, you know, the biggest treat in the world for me was going to Cardiff or Swansea, where you had to drive, you know, those are the closest towns to me, and getting to go to McDonald's. You know, my favorite shows were He-Man and Thundercats, and when I was 12, I literally wrote to McDonald's and said to them, you know, when I'm older, I want to work for you. I want to work in your marketing. I want to run your marketing. you know, I loved Coca-Cola and American wrestling. And so I kind of loved America. You know, I had my first honeymoon. On my first honeymoon, we went and did Route 66. And the reason that my, my now ex-wife agreed to that was because she knew how much I loved America. So, you know, it's kind of ironic, really, that I have this reputation online as being like a massive America hater. But in a way, there is a kind of psychological component, because this is like coming to terms with the fact of being a kind of fully colonized subject yourself, if that makes any sense. And I'm trying to like unpack that. And if I rail against it a bit hard sometimes, it is because of how successful it has been. So I will just explain, you know, some of my own motivations there. And, you know, I've come to the conclusion that the dire straits that we're in are basically because of this, because of this has happened. Not because it's happened to me specifically, but because it's happened to us as a people. And, you know, not just Britain, but to Europe, and indeed, weirdly, to America itself. Like, America has colonized itself. I know that sounds like a strange thing to say. But really, there's a kind of, there's an ideology, a kind of way of being that has supplanted what is, what should be true and local and authentic. And all of those things have, you know, come to be dissolved and destroyed by this, you know, corrosive acid, in my view. So, yeah, it's kind of a difficult thing to, for people to understand sometimes, I think, that, you know, my, it sounds so strange, but my hatred comes from a place of love. And I think what sometimes the disconnect is that a lot of the people, especially the younger people, don't actually have that love in the first place. They've only known to hate it. Whereas I'm kind of coming from a place where I kind of love it as well. So yeah, it's a difficult thing to, it's a really difficult thing to explain. Anyway, just before we get going, I do write books. You should buy Populist Delusion and Prophets of Doom, my last two books. They will kind of explain a lot of my thinking. But I also run courses at the academic agency. Best-selling one is The Trivium, which I'll play the ad for now. And then when we come out of that, I'm going to review episodes 3 and 4 of An Oceans Apart, which basically cover the FDR years and really tells the story of how America got into World War II and how really the World War II was a vehicle for America to take over British power. And at the same time, to come back to the title of the actual episode, it shows, you know, I think perfectly why Churchill should go down in history as probably the worst British leader of all time. If you measure his stated goals against what actually happened, the actual results of his policies. But anyway, well, we'll come back to that. First of all, I'm going to play my ad for The Trivium, the best-selling course at the academic agency. Buy it now.
Academic Agency.
All right, we're back. So What I'm going to do, as I did last time, I'm going to give you a kind of broad overview of what these are about, and then we're going to watch through some parts of it. Now, I'm going to have to be a little bit careful here because these documentaries are about World War II. They really show the political side, and the focus is on Britain and America. But along the way, there is some stock footage of the mid-century Germans and Mustache Man. And I know YouTube is very funny about the symbols of the mid-century Germans being shown on screen. I know somebody recently who was just showing a meme where somebody had like badly drawn that symbol in the background of some sort of meme, and they had the video was struck down. So I don't want to. I need to be really careful about showing that on screen. But otherwise, it seems like there's not a lot in these documentaries that is going to get flagged up. So we're going to watch some parts of it together. The documentary starts in 1927, and it really very briefly touches on the Great Depression. But the real focus is of the first episode is how FDR tried to persuade the Americans that they needed to get into World War II, and how he dealt with the fact that literally 85% of the public was against taking America into World War II. Okay. The hero, if you want to put it that way, of the first episode we're going to watch here is Charles Lindbergh, known for being a great pilot. I think he was the first. Was he the first pilot to do a transatlantic flight? But he was great guy, and he led a movement called American First, America First. And it shows really there's this lobby group called the White Committee. And it shows the kind of propaganda war between them and Charles Lindbergh. But in the background of it all is the kind of, I wouldn't call it Cold War, but there's a kind of unspoken rivalry between Britain and America that is in the background of all of this, whereby Britain has got an eye on how to keep hold of its empire, and FDR in particular, the Americans more generally, but especially FDR, inherited from Woodrow Wilson this kind of anti-colonial, anti-European empire attitude, whereby FDR had this vision of a world after World War II, where the old ways of doing things, empire and colonies and so on, would be a thing of the past. And there would be a new world order, if you want to put it that way. That is the kind of overarching story of both of these episodes we're going to watch. Okay. And then the second episode, I thought the second episode was really well done, is much more closely focused on World War II itself. And really, it tells the story of how the control over the troops, the control over the war plan itself, as a microcosm of the power struggle between Britain and America and Churchill and FDR. One of the things that I found when I was watching these was that my already low opinion of Churchill got even lower during the whole thing. It's not just that he's an idiot and every single decision that he made pretty much was bad, apart from his invasion of North Africa, or what is his campaign in North Africa went all right. But apart from that little bit that seemed to go all right for him, pretty much every decision he made Britain weaker and made America stronger. It's not only that, it's the fact that he's so, like, feminine and manipulative, and kind of he's got this idea that he can just use kind of like emotional arguments like a woman to just kind of get people to do the things he wants. He's like a, you know, and then if you've ever got into an argument with a woman, of which I've been obviously been in many such arguments in my lifetime, you'll know that there's no actual principle behind what she's saying. She'll just kind of justify whatever she wants in the moment, right? Using pure ad hoc reasoning. In fact, lots of the time, there's not any reasoning at all. I really find Churchill to be like that only as a politician. And it's what's particularly galling to me is that at no part in his thinking did he ever like reflect, like, Britain didn't have to be in this position. It could have taken different decisions at every point and come out of it so much stronger. And we're going to be exploring that as time goes on. Really, his belligerence is one of the kind of, you know, the person he reminded me most, really, of most from recent memory was Vladimir Zelensky in Ukraine. Zelensky, you know, as we've watched, he's a hopeless war against the Russians, which he was never going to win. Okay. And Zelensky over the past 2 years has basically gone around the world asking for money, basically begging for money and, you know, using kind of emotional arguments to get more money. And essentially this is what Churchill does throughout these two documentaries, kind of begging about, looking for support, you know, help us out, you know. And it's just like, he didn't even need to do it in the first place, because unlike Ukraine, which is basically a small and not very significant country, he had control of a bloody empire. So we will get on to all of those things soon. But I have also, there's this guy on Twitter called, his name is Andreas Kouros. And he's one of these kind of Tory boy types, but I think he's got a pretty big online presence. And he's been continually kind of shilling for Churchill and calling him the greatest and like defending his legacy against, you know, people who moan about the Bengal famine and so on. I have publicly challenged him to, I never do debates. You know, I hate debates, but I've challenged him to a public debate. I would appear in person, and if somebody wants to host it and sell tickets to watch that debate, I would gladly take part in a debate with him on Churchill, because for my money, he is the worst leader this country has ever had. And I include in that calculus people like Henry VI or like Richard III or, you know, you name it. Like, you know, we've had some bad kings in history. For me, Churchill takes the biscuit, because the if you look at the scale of the humiliation he brought on this country, it's pretty staggering. Now this documentary that we're about to watch doesn't really have a kind of anti-Churchill thesis, but as ever with Adam Curtis, he gives you the raw materials. He gives you 80% of the stuff that you need. He basically like shows you without telling you what you need, like all of the things that you'd need to know. The last thing I'll say before we get into watching some of the footage here is that what another remarkable fact of this documentary, made in 1988, is that it covers World War II and it doesn't mention the Jews at any point. There is no mention of the Holocaust. There's no mention of Jews in Britain or America. It purely focuses on the realpolitik of Britain and America and its respective interests, and on the kind of relationship between Churchill and FDR, which is kind of interesting in and of itself. It's just not a consideration at all in this documentary, which I'm not sure, like, if that would be, if a documentary was made on World War II today like this, or on the relationship between Britain and America, I don't know how, like, if that would be inserted and why it was completely left out in this documentary in 1988. So I don't know. I don't watch a lot of World War II documentaries. Maybe that's standard. Well, what do people know? So let us now get on. Now, I understand that, you know, by saying that I believe Churchill's the worst leader ever, I am flying in the face of what I would call like a huge Churchill industry and a huge kind of vested interest that I've experienced all my life to get into what my buddy Morgoth calls bulldog nationalism, spitfire nationalism. You know, Churchill actually is our greatest hero. He embodies the spirit of what it means to be British and all this sort of stuff. I entirely disagree with all of that. But we'll get into, I think it's easier to understand that once you consider some of the things that we're considering here. So let's make a start then, because the documentary starts with an absolute banger quote from Churchill himself.
And other public television stations.
In 1927, the United States drew up plans for a possible naval war against Britain. Negotiations for restricting the size of their rival fleets had just broken down. If war were declared, the American Navy would steam across the Atlantic to blockade Britain, cutting her off from her trade with her empire and leaving America, not Britain, in command of the seas. Winston Churchill, then Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer, wrote, "No doubt it is quite right to go on talking about war with the United States being unthinkable, but everyone knows this is not true. However foolish and disastrous such a war would be, we cannot and must not put ourselves in the power of the United States."
I'll just repeat that. Winston Churchill said, in 1927, "We cannot and must not put ourselves in the power of the United States." Direct quote, Winston Churchill, 1927. I want you to remember that as we carry on watching what happens.
And yet, only 13 years later, in this English country house where he came on moonlit nights to escape Hitler's bombers, that same Winston Churchill, now Prime Minister of Great Britain, was writing to the American president, urging him to come to the rescue of Britain to save her from defeat by Germany. It was 1940, Britain's darkest hour, and Churchill knew that most Americans didn't believe their country should join in the war, that many didn't even think Britain should be given any help. This is the story of a different Battle of Britain, not the one fought out over the skies of London, but a battle of words fought to persuade the American people that Britain's war with Germany was their war. And it's the story of how Britain did find herself in America's power, because the only alternative was defeat.
So yeah, next bit now, I think, shows quite a bit of the mid-century Germans. But I wanted to fast forward to where we get to the pivotal moment of Neville Chamberlain signing the famous appeasement document. I think it's around here somewhere, because this is really where it starts to go all wrong. And for those people who watched my mini-series on the Cigar Stream, Britain's Blunder, now behind the paywall, by the way, but I read through an entire book called Britain's Blunder. Really, it's all right here. And it's quite interesting to now see these people like in the flesh and what the sentiments were on the ground. So this is like Britain entering the war. It's around here.
Hitler's determination to create a Third Reich embracing all German peoples drove Europe into crisis, while in the Far East, Japan's attacks on China threatened the outposts of the British Empire. Neville Chamberlain knew that to resist these threats would lead to war, a war Britain would lose without America's support. Since there was no hope of that, he chose the path of appeasement. In September 1938, he flew to Munich to meet Hitler, who was now claiming the right to annex the Sudeten part of Czechoslovakia.
Now, contrary to Tory boy opinion and kind of popular mainstream history, I think this was correct from Neville Chamberlain. And I think Neville Chamberlain is one of the most kind of unfairly derided people in history, really. You have to consider the fact on the ground. Britain was absolutely on its ass after World War One, right? Just bankrupt. Like, they'd spent so much money on World War One that they didn't have the resources to fight this war. Okay. They just didn't have the resources. Despite like running like a fifth of the world or a quarter of the world, wherever it was, they just had spent too much treasure on the First World War. So really what Britain should have done during this period is focused on kind of getting back on its feet after World War One, not plunging ourselves into another war against the Germans. The other thing that nobody ever talks about, which I will flag up here, is that Britain really, you know, it had all those territories abroad, in not just India, but like lots of Africa and many other territories. You can have a look at the map as it stood in the 1930s. Rather than concentrating on, you know, those territories and concentrating on that sphere of influence, like, what does it matter who runs bloody the Sudetenland or Czechoslovakia or even Poland? Who gives a shit? People will talk about like balance of power and all of this. Really, this is something this is something for the Russians to concern themselves with, because if you look at what happened after the war, all of those territories ended up being run by Stalin anyway. They all ended up being run by Russia anyway. So what? You could have had a scenario where, you know, however that played out, it would have played out, and it could have played out with the Germans destroying the USSR or vice versa or whatever. But rather than in a post-war environment, Britain just being a country on its knees, it could have been Britain being a country which still ran an empire. And if the Germans or the Russians wanted to try it on, well, maybe that by that point we would have been in a position to tell them where to go, as it were. Instead, basically an already bankrupt country completely destroyed itself, fighting a war that basically should never have concerned it in the first place. You know, for what? As I put it on Twitter, you know, literally like giving away the empire so that the Czechs could be ruled by Stalin and not Hitler. Brilliant. Brilliant. And this is the thing that I still don't understand about the neocons today. It's the same mentality, right? Like, why don't you concentrate on your actual sphere of influence rather than worrying about what happened in somebody else's sphere of influence? Britain didn't control those territories. So why did Britain think that it could just dictate the foreign policy of Germany in the way that they wanted to? The belligerence over that particular issue has been absolutely devastating. Not just for Britain's world standing, but for all the millions of people who died in that war. Didn't need to. Anyway, let's carry on.
At Munich, Chamberlain and Hitler signed a piece of paper. It was agreed that Hitler could have the Sudetenland, but that this would be his last demand.
This morning, I had another talk with the German Chancellor, Herr Hitler. And here is the paper.
Note, by the way, how in this point, the German Chancellor was just the leader of Germany. He wasn't like the kind of cartoon villain that he is today. He was just another thing that you have to think of is the mid-century Germans was just the government of Germany at that time, rather than some like aberration. Or, and this is the, this is another part of Boomer Truth regime that I really dislike, which is the notion that any government that we don't like, or who does things that, you know, who wants to pursue a foreign policy that we don't like, are rogue governments. They're illegitimate. You know, the government of Germany wasn't really the government of Germany. They and again, where this thinking leads is today, you know, trying to delegitimize like Vladimir Putin is clearly in control of Russia, and you know that is the Russian government. But in the way that in this mindset, in this Churchillian mindset, Putin's not a legitimate leader. That's not actually the legitimate leader. We don't have any lines of communication into him. We have to act as if he too is much like Hitler or something like that. They do the same thing to the government in Iran. They do the same thing to many other governments who they just won't recognize as being the legitimate government because they don't run a liberal democracy or something like that. So, but it's just interesting here to see Chamberlain just talk about Hitler as if he's just this is just the leader of Germany at the end of the day. And again, an adult response to World War II and to what actually happened during this period should see the government of Germany at that time as just the government of Germany, not as this kind of uniquely evil aberration, that was never legitimate or something like that. But, you know, that is not how the kind of post-war order has developed.
Which bears his name upon it as well as mine.
Coming back in the plane from Munich, Chamberlain said to us that he thought that he ought to give the maximum publicity to the piece of paper that Hitler had signed, pledging that Germany and Britain would settle their affairs by negotiation and not by force in future years. He thought if Hitler broke this at any time, then world opinion would react pretty strongly, and in particular America. He had it in mind the importance of America's support if Hitler should come to break the promise and if war should result. He was beginning the process of wooing America. It was something that didn't particularly come natural to him to woo America, but he was beginning the process.
In March 1939, Hitler broke his word and occupied the remainder of Czechoslovakia.
But again, like, so what? I mean, the as we talked about in Britain's blunder, you know, they weren't treating the Germans very well in that part of the world. There were 3 million Germans there. He had his reasons, just like Putin's got his reasons for going into Ukraine. At the end of the day, so what? You know, like, you understand what I'm saying, right? It was no business of Britain's and no business of America's if he wants to pursue that foreign policy in that part of the world. Now, it may have been Russia's bit business because you're getting into Russian sphere of influence. And okay, if Russia and Germany want to have a war then, let them go at it. It doesn't, like, you didn't need to sacrifice the lives of millions of our boys in that war. And the reason I'm foreloading this argument for Britain at this point is, as we'll see, this was exactly the argument that the Americans, you know, the actually patriotic Americans like Charles Lindbergh, as we'll see, used for them. Why should the American boys die for this war? It's got nothing to do with any of them. So anyway, we will let's just move on here. We will get to now. There's this big push. Let's get to Churchill coming in, because they use the coronation, they use the kind of royalty as a kind of propaganda weapon. The coronation of George here, they use it as a way of winning the hearts and minds of many Americans back, to remind Americans of the kind of common bond and all of this sort of thing. So let's just watch a little bit of this PR battle here.
America by a British monarch, captivated the Republic.
Friendly and wholehearted salutation. So glad to see you. Delighted to be here. No stiffly starched diplomatic chill. American president and British sovereign.
The formalities were also recorded on this home movie, shot by the president's secretary to the Treasury.
The effect of the royal visit was a surge of pro-British feeling throughout the United States. That is to say, sympathy with the ties which have bound us together for a long time.
Now this welcoming pageant in the United States signifies a promise of closer friendship between Great Britain and the United States. Washington receives the British sovereigns with a popular ovation. American cheers for a king.
Of course.
All absolute bullshit, by the way, all of this. This is just kind of like, again, the white boys need to die in their wars. That's basically what all of this came down to. Trying to persuade Americans that, you know, what's in Britain's interest is in their interest. Clearly, that was never, that, you know, as this documentary will show, that was never the case on either side. But anyway.
It would be a mistake to think that sympathy would necessarily mean an involvement if war were to break out. And the feeling in the United States of wishing to distance themselves from threatening events in Europe was very strong at that stage, and no president, I don't think, could have overridden it.
Roosevelt's sympathy for Britain was more than sentiment. He believed that if Britain successfully resisted Hitler, America would be spared the need to fight. It was therefore in America's interests to give what help she could.
The king expressed his grave concern over the approach of war in Europe. Father agreed with him and was very, very much interested in having the king understand that in any eventuality that we would stand behind England, even if we weren't involved in the war, in striving to give what assistance we could.
The important part of this, by the way, for anybody who's missing some of this context, if I had my buddy Radlib here, I'm sure he'd tell you the same, was that even early on, even in 1938, 1939, it was in the thinking of the American and the British elites that when push comes to shove, America is going to get involved somehow, okay? It was in their thinking all the way back in 38, 39. And there's this kind of narrative that people like to tell that, you know, FDR had to be persuaded and all this sort of stuff. I mean, it's not true. They already knew that when push comes to shove, they'd make it one way or the other, they would make it happen. But first of all, let's see how many British boys can die in the war before you have to bring in the American boys. That was FDR's thinking.
British government, seeing that war was inevitable, was now frantically rearming to make up for lost time. As in World War I, they turned to American industry for help. Lockheed, then a struggling plane manufacturer near Los Angeles, was working flat out to deliver bombers to Britain while the peace held. Once war broke out, the Neutrality Act would halt any further supplies. And despite the promises he'd made to the king, President Roosevelt would have to accept the restrictions imposed by Congress.
This is before the war now. So this is Lockheed Martin, this is an American arms manufacturer, quickly building planes so that they could get them over to the British before the war started, just in case, you know, Congress would start looking at the Neutrality Act. I mean, it's just so naked and blatant.
The signs were that the American people would strongly support neutrality. As a popular song of the time put it, wherever in history the British turned up, there was trouble.
Paul Revere took a ride just to look around the countryside. All at once, off got giddy. Here come the British, bang, bang. Washington at Valley Forge.
Here come the British, bang, bang. That is the name of the episode, by the way. Here come the British. Bang, bang.
George tried to cross the river. Look out, George. All at once his boat got skittish. Here come the British. Bang, bang. Whoa. Just look around no matter where. You'll find that the British are there. Napoleon at Waterloo. Wright and Josephine are Billy Doo. Josie, I have got to close it. Close this epistle. There goes the whistle. Here come the British with a bang, bang.
You know, what's fascinating is that that has continued to be true even to this day, even right up to now, when Britain is a complete shadow of what it used to be. They're still, our government is still the most belligerent, kind of yappy, up for war, mental government on earth, pretty much. I don't think there's a single war that our government has turned down. You know, they're always up for it for some reason.
This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently this country is at war with Germany.
I mean, they shouldn't have signed the bloody thing in the first place, but you can go back to my Britain's blunder thing for having a look at the... There's a whole episode where we look at the pledge, you know, the pledge to Poland. And I'm sure the Poles are really, really grateful for the British help, considering what happened to Poland after World War II. I mean, thanks. There were actually accounts from the Poles saying, actually, probably we'd have been better off being conquered by the Germans than by the Russians. But anyway, that's history.
Chamberlain's declaration triggered the American Neutrality Act. The Lockheed factory and hundreds of others fell idle as the sale of armaments was embargoed. But Roosevelt persuaded Congress to allow what was called cash and carry. It forced Lockheed and other companies to make curious new arrangements with their customers. Britain could still buy planes, but only if they did not leave American soil under their own power.
Now, I found this was absolutely fascinating, this next bit. One of the best bits of the documentary, this watch.
Lockheed instructed their pilots to head for a remote town on the Canadian border.
It was a hell of a run. It was in the wintertime. The snowstorms going up through Great Falls, Montana, you were just absolutely blind most of the time and only could see straight down. You become quite a navigator when you've been a bush pilot in Alaska. You don't ask where the moose are. You go find them.
This is the American-Canadian border. That field is in America, that field is in Canada. The American pilots flew the planes into this field and left them. A Canadian farmer brought a team of horses across the border, hitched them onto the front of the planes, dragged them across the border into Canada, where Canadian pilots went aboard and flew them off for delivery to Britain.
Fucking ridiculous. They actually did that. So that's how they got round the Neutrality Act. I mean, it's just so fucking ridiculous. It's so amazing.
There's nothing very exciting around up here. And we went every day. Every time we got word that there was a plane coming, you see, we'd wait and a plane would land and horses would hook on and away they would go across the line. And of course, then we had to go home. The excitement was over.
All winter long, the planes kept landing and taking off from these fields. It was the oddest example of how things stood between Britain and America, with the American government held back by the Neutrality Act, but still trying to aid the British war effort. For those who thought America should stay right out of the war, and feared that if you began helping a country at war, you were inevitably dragged into the war yourself, it was an ominous sign. And so the stage was set for a battle between two conflicting views of what America should do.
at least 85% of the people did not want to go to the war. It's very natural. One of the biggest populations in America, the German, enormous population all over. The Italians were against going to war. The veterans who'd fought in World War I were against going to war. The farmers were against going to war. And union labor was going against war. Over 85% were steadily against going to war. They didn't even know where Danzig was.
But populist illusion fans, even if 85% of the public are against something, if the elites want it, it's going to happen, as you well know.
Remember the United States in 1940? The lights were bright. The New York World's Fair was in its second year. The Brooklyn Dodgers had a good team. There was a bumper crop in the wheat states. There were a lot of automobiles.
On the 10th of May, 1940, a spectacular firework display celebrated the end of the New York World's Fair. At the same moment, 3,000 miles away, Hitler launched his blitzkrieg. German troops stormed through Holland, Belgium, and France, driving the British army back towards the sea. In London, Prime Minister Chamberlain, who'd lost the confidence of Parliament, resigned. In his place came Winston Churchill, taking power as Britain faced disaster.
Probably the worst thing that ever happened to Britain right there.
Out from the hell that is Dunkirk, back from the field thrust.
So let's move on a little bit, because we're going to have a look now at... In fact, this little sequence is quite good, because all I could think when I was watching it was, what do they die for? What were they fighting for? Why did they give their lives? Anyway, let's have a little watch of it.
So the German war machine comes the BEF. This is the most magnificent sight of a generation. This is the army under its magnificent leader. While these men live and breathe, Britain is safe. The enemy will never pass.
The day Dunkirk fell, Churchill made an impassioned speech in the House of Commons. Scorning Germany's success, he promised to lead a country that would fight on to the last, on the beaches and on the landing grounds, until he said, in God's good...
I mean, there are still people saying they gave their lives for us, did they? Is that really what happened, though? How can you still say that after everything we've seen since the end of World War II? The same traitorous parties that took us into this sat there in Parliament in 2008 or 2009. And you can look this up if you don't believe me. And they voted that there's no such thing as an indigenous British person. No such thing as an indigenous native Briton, according to Parliament. Let's carry on.
Time, a new world, with all its power and its might, steps forth to the rescue of the old. Churchill knew that the hope of American support, which he held out to the people of Britain, might never be fulfilled. He also knew that without it, Britain and her empire were doomed.
Churchill realized right from the beginning that the entry of America was vital, and he started right away by establishing a telegraphic relationship with Roosevelt, whom he didn't in fact know. He'd only met him once at a dinner in London.
Now remember, this is the same guy who in 1927 said, we must never allow ourselves to fall under the power of the United States, has now maneuvered himself into such a position where he is desperate for the help of the United States. Talk about a fuck up. He basically made a self-fulfilling prophecy when he said that, because, you know, by getting himself in a war that he could not win on his own, he basically had to mortgage off the entire empire.
1918. Years after the war, Churchill said to me, no lover ever...
How many peace offers did Hitler make? You know, we went through all of the different times that Hitler offered peace. You know, 39, 40, every single time, belligerence, belligerence, belligerence. No, never surrender, never surrender.
We didn't in fact know. We'd only met him once at a dinner in London in 1918. Years after the war, Churchill said to me, no lover ever studied the whims of his mistress as I did those of President Roosevelt.
What sort of thing is that to say? You know, no lover ever studied the whims of his mistress as I did President Roosevelt. I mean, he's like, his whole strategy throughout this, as we'll see going forward, is to be like a kind of, how do you call it? Like a power bottom. Is that what they call it? Power bottom. I'm not very good because I've, you know, never had sex, but you understand what I'm saying, right? It's so like kind of, you know, I'll come in as the submissive junior partner, you know, and I'll kind of seduce and caress. It really is kind of just very Tory boy. I've often joked that the Tories are like, you know, political bottoms. They are always doing this sort of thing. And Churchill really is really fitting that it's Churchill who's their hero, because this is what they're like in all ways, in every respect. It's how they behave in every scenario.
On the 22nd of June, France surrendered. Britain stood alone against Hitler. Churchill cabled Roosevelt asking for the loan of 50 old American destroyers last used in World War I. Nothing is more important than to guard our coast against invasion, he wrote. Not a day should be lost. Roosevelt replied that...
Sorry, I should clarify. I do not actually know what a power bottom is, I'm afraid. So I've just seen that lingo bandied about.
Though he would like to help, Congress would prevent it. Churchill wrote again, we must ask, as a matter of life or death, to be reinforced with these destroyers. But for 2 months...
So I want to skip on a little bit, because there's this whole section now. Yes, here we go. This is the bit where you get this White Committee versus the America First. Let's watch a bit of that, because very interesting. And I wonder how much they, you know, I have no conception of what the American education system, to the extent that they've got one, which isn't just kind of like venerating black people or whatever, but is this covered in American schools, this White Committee versus America First stuff? Do they ever talk about how many people are against getting into World War II in mainstream American education? Or do they teach you about Charles Lindbergh or any of this sort of stuff? I was never taught any of this stuff when I cover World War II, because we always studied it from the German point of view, bizarrely. So anyway, carry on.
Nothing is more important than to guard our coast against invasion, he wrote. Not a day should be lost. Roosevelt replied that though he would like to help, Congress would prevent it. Churchill wrote again, we must ask, as a matter of life or death, to be reinforced with these destroyers. But for 2 months he heard nothing. In desperation, Churchill tried once more. I must tell you that in the long history of the world, this is the thing to do now. Roosevelt again refused. The American view was that Britain was on the verge of defeat, and there was no point in letting American destroyers fall into German hands. The American ambassador in London endorsed this gloomy view.
If I am called an appeaser because I oppose the entrance of this country into the present war, I cheerfully plead guilty. And so must every one of you who want to keep America out of this war.
In the late summer of 1940, there were signs of a change of heart. American newspapers announced the formation of a pressure group to encourage Congress to help Britain.
A pressure group? Now, I don't know much about these people or who was behind them or what the money behind them was, but interesting that you get the organized minority forming very quickly to get one over on the disorganized majority. But they would not actually go without an organized minority resistance. So let's carry on watching.
The vice president of the White Committee was a famous Hollywood film star.
The White Committee's role was to support anything which would help the Allies and help Britain at that time. We had to persuade the president, who was sympathetic, but didn't want to get too far ahead of the public. I remember being in the room once when he said that he had to be like the captain in front of his troops. If he got too far ahead in expressing his own sympathies and opinion, then he would lose the people behind. He could only be a little bit ahead, and that it was our job to push public opinion, and he would always be a little bit ahead like that.
But there was an equally powerful group of Americans who were completely opposed to helping Britain.
Based.
Their figurehead was an American folk hero, Charles Lindbergh.
Based.
In 1927, he'd been the first man to fly the Atlantic alone. In the 30s, Lindbergh and his wife had left the United States after the kidnap and murder of their baby son. They lived in Europe, where Lindbergh became an expert on air power. He toured German aircraft factories, was feted by the Nazis, and accepted a decoration from Field Marshal Goering.
Based.
At the outbreak of war, Lindbergh came home to explain why America should keep out of this one. In June 1940, a measure of his influence, his views were carried live on all three main radio networks.
Based.
These wars in Europe are not wars in which our civilization is defending itself against some Asiatic intruder. This is simply one more of those age-old struggles within our own family of nations. If we enter fighting for democracy abroad, we may end by losing it at home.
The delay on the destroyers was caused by Lindbergh's appreciation of the Battle of Britain. He had told us that within 2 weeks after the Luftwaffe's all-out attack, the RAF would be driven to seek refuge in Scottish and Irish bases if it were not entirely destroyed. And Roosevelt was quite smart enough to see that in that case, there wasn't a great deal to be gained by transferring destroyers, huh?
Was Roosevelt at that stage then hoping still to keep America out of the war?
Certainly not. No. He was praying for the success, your success, in the Battle of Britain. But he wanted to see how it came out before he took action.
FDR, such a brilliant friend, you know. Let's just wait to see what happens and see how many British people can die, and then we may get involved. We'll see how we play it. So, I mean, one thing I will say is that, you know, one of the things that really comes out of this documentary, I think, is that, you know, Churchill is this kind of, in my opinion, kind of like feminine, manipulative character, power bottom, right? FDR is much more a chess player, I think. He's much more kind of, you know, from a purely cold realpolitik point of view, I can appreciate FDR as a skilled player of the game. I do appreciate, you know, from his own point of view, FDR is actually pretty good at the game, if that makes any sense. I disagree with all the things he did, obviously, but, you know, just as I appreciate Tony Blair as a very skilled operator, FDR had it as well. He'd have good football manager stats in key categories. So,
the underground bunker, where, protected from the Luftwaffe's bombs, the British cabinet met during the war. It was clear by August 1940 to Churchill and his ministers here, and much more important, across the Atlantic in Washington, that Britain wasn't on the verge of collapse. And Roosevelt decided that he could not.
Yeah, the guy who got elected four times as a skilled politician is not a particularly big call. I agree.
Now offer the 50 old destroyers. But he told Churchill there was a price to pay. In return, he wanted 8 military bases on the eastern seaboard of the United States, on British possessions in the West Atlantic. Molasses, he called it, to sweeten the pill for Congress. When Churchill and the cabinet heard this, they were aghast. They didn't see why Britain should give up possessions in return for the destroyers. In the cabinet minutes, it records a formal bargain on the lines proposed was out of the question.
And this is another theme, I would say, is the complete delusion of Churchill to believe that, like, Churchill wanted to kind of have his cake and eat it too, right? This is why I say he's a moron, okay? He believed that he could skillfully kind of persuade FDR to help win World War II for him, and at the same time, not give up the British Empire. Fucking stupid, just absolutely delusional and stupid to believe that he could thread that needle, you know. And he didn't have the skill. Frankly, he didn't have the skill to do that. didn't have the acumen to pull that off. I don't know if it could have been pulled off, to be honest. But yeah, let's carry on.
But they soon realized that really they had no choice in the matter. The cabinet was already being told that Britain was running out of the gold and dollars she needed to buy arms. And so, reluctantly, a few days later, the Destroyers for Bases deal was signed.
So, yeah, America. Another cuck from Churchill. This is another theme, by the way. Belligerence. I don't want to do it. Okay, I cuck. That's basically like... These two documentaries is basically a long series of Churchill cucking to everything, basically, because winning the war against, never surrender, fight them on the beaches, etc., is more important than everything else. You know, let's destroy every single last vestige of British power just so long as we beat the evil mustache man.
And here are the first of the ex-American destroyers arriving as a timely reinforcement to our flotillas. The ships are old, but having been kept in good fighting trim, they'll prove of the utmost value.
The destroyers were ready for the scrap heap. They were really not very good. It was rather a tough deal in many ways because we got these bases in perpetuity for the United States. But that was necessary, I feel, politically, because the American people were always being reminded that we might be taken advantage of by the very shrewd Europeans, and particularly by the British, who were very, very canny, and we were just simple folk, and so therefore we had to make a tough deal.
I think there was the feeling, if I remember rightly, that it was a very hard bargain, but one that had to be accepted. And in a sense, there was a small sop, that we weren't handing over the bases, we were only leasing them for 99 years.
Cope!
So, to that extent, we weren't giving away the British Empire.
Cope! I mean, this is another classic Tory boy trait. Every single cuck, they cope about it, and they're, oh, it's not really, and they use these little technicalities. It's just cope at the end of the day.
But I think the need for them was so great that, it just had to be accepted. We certainly weren't going to forego getting the destroyers for a matter of pride or bargaining.
All right, so we're going to skip over this next bit now, because basically what they do is they use this Edward Murrow, who's a famous American journalist. I think there was a film. Correct me if I'm wrong. I seem to remember there was a film where George Clooney played him. I could be making that up, but I feel like I watched a film once about Edward R. Murrow where George Clooney was Murrow. But basically they use footage of Blitzkrieg in London and bombing, the German bombing campaign to rally support in America. They thought that they could pull on the heartstrings. If Americans saw London being bombed, you know, it changed their mind. So that they kept on doing these live broadcasts, basically as part of the propaganda campaign to try to win more support. Thankfully, based Limburg was still there. But ultimately, well... You know what happened, but let's carry on moving forward a little bit, because we don't need to see like the bombing propaganda stuff. I mean, this bit is funny. I'm going to play this little bit because it's funny, but obviously the bombing campaign by the Germans actually did happen. What I'm saying is that it was being used as propaganda to try to strong arm Americans into supporting the war, basically. But This bit of footage was funny, so I'll play it.
Good.
Hello.
Hello, is that you, Neville?
Yes.
How are you doing, old boy?
Uh-huh.
I see. See, that's grand. I say, can you make that funny clicking noise like that? Go on again.
Hello, Paula.
Hello, Daddy dear. How are you?
Fine. I would say swell, I suppose. I thought you'd have a terrific accent.
No, I managed to keep it off.
I got all the boys at St. John's listening, you know.
Oh, yes?
Oh, boys,
Good luck.
Rather.
Daddy, I haven't received the £5 yet.
But there was a backlash from those who believed propaganda was being used to persuade America to fight.
Yeah, they believe. Yeah, of course propaganda was being used. Yeah, they believe propaganda. I mean, that's what was happening.
There are still interests in this country and abroad who will do their utmost to draw us into war. Against these interests, we must be continuously on guard. But American opinion is now definitely and overwhelmingly against our involvement.
Opponents of America's involvement now formed their own pressure group, America First.
America First.
Its figurehead was Charles Lindbergh. 2 months after its foundation, America First was already a mass movement.
America First had a strange conglomeration of human beings. There were ultra-conservatives,
based
people who later supported Senator McCarthy.
Based.
There were middle-of-the-roaders. There were socialists. I was one who was drawn into the movement by my socialist friends. I thought it was possible that Germany would win. And my feeling that we had to stay out and remain strong to preserve Western civilization, that was a very, very potent feeling with me.
As Lindbergh toured America, his audiences grew, the message always the same: America should keep out of Britain's war.
Based.
We believe that the security of our country lies in the strength and character of our own people, and not in fighting foreign wars.
Lindbergh spoke at Yale University, invited by a young student, Kingman Brewster.
Basically, I think there was a feeling that Hitler could not invade us and we could not invade him. The Atlantic was just too big for the technology of war at the time.
And therefore, if Britain went under and France went under, that wasn't America's affair.
Well, that was not so. It's a question of how much of a price are you willing...
You see, the problem with, even with Dimbleby's question is it overlooks the fact that Britain didn't actually need to be in the war. He could have just signed peace at any time. And, you know, there's no reason to believe that Hitler would have just kind of maniacally tried to, like, conquer Britain after that. They were only fighting Britain because Britain declared war on Germany in the first place, as we went over. His plan was to unite the German people under the Reich or whatever. Well, fucking leave him to it. We still controlled a fifth of the world. Didn't need to get involved in all of this. But no, let's, instead of that, never surrender, and let's drag the bloody Americans in now as well.
...willing to pay, and that the price in terms of democracy was greater if we got involved in an intercontinental war than even if Hitler succeeded in dominating Europe.
But the view in Britain was that the America First people would let Europe go hang. I mean, was that...
Well, the consequence was, I'm sure, if we didn't get in the war, the chances of Hitler's winning would be greatly increased. But it wasn't because we thought Europe ought to go hang. It was because we didn't think America should hang in order to prevent that.
Were you right to think that?
No, I don't think so in retrospect. I think we were right on the basis of what we then knew.
See, the thing is, he had to say that because in the post-war world, you get into trouble for not believing that, you see. So he is now in a situation where his side lost, basically. So, he kind of has to say that.
Our advice had been followed, it would have been a disaster.
America First served notice on Roosevelt that many Americans would not accept his support for Britain. 1940 was presidential election year. Roosevelt's opponent, Wendell Willkie, accused him of dragging the United States into war.
Accurate.
Roosevelt was forced to repeat a promise he'd made at its outbreak.
Let no man or woman, thoughtlessly or falsely, talk of sending American armies to European fields.
Look at this fucking liar. Can you believe this? Look at the sheer gall on this guy.
I hope the United States will keep out of this war.
What a liar. I mean, we've just seen his clandestine plan to, like, ship American planes across the Canadian border, all the support that they've been giving already. Look at the sheer fucking lies on FDR here.
I believe that it will.
Election Day 1940, democracy's greatest drama. President Roosevelt, like 50 million other Americans, prepares to cast his ballot here at Hyde Park.
Name, please.
Franklin D. Roosevelt.
So he did hoodwink the American people.
I think in a literal sense you could say he did. I think he hoped that he wouldn't have to.
Yeah, in a literal sense, he just barefacedly lied to the American people to get in office again. Just tell it like it is, Elliot.
But I don't think that he really, in his heart of hearts, ever believed that we would have a victory over Hitler without the United States being involved.
The results are now conclusive. Roosevelt wins. Broadway goes wild. A roaring sea of frenzied humanity shouts itself hoarse at the election.
Once re-elected, Roosevelt was politically secure enough to respond to Churchill's desperate pleas for direct...
Once he'd blatantly lied to the American people, FDR was politically secure enough then to do the complete opposite of what he promised that he wouldn't do, basically.
Financial help. He proposed a scheme called Lend-Lease. America would give Britain the supplies she needed and not ask for payment until the war was over. To convince Americans that his instinct was right, he went on the offensive, making a live radio broadcast to explain what he had in mind. The night he spoke, London was in the grip of the worst firebombing attack of the whole war.
My friends, this is not a fireside chat on war. It is a talk on national security. If Great Britain goes down, the Axis powers will control the continents of Europe.
What did he say? Let no man say that America should send boys to die in European war. And yet here he is, like, literally 2 months later or whatever, saying this. It's remarkable.
Asia, Africa, Australasia, and the high seas. It is no exaggeration to say that all of us, in all the America, would be living at the point of a gun. There are American citizens.
So, see, it's the same lie, by the way, over and over again. Oh, if we don't get involved in this, then the crazy mustache man is going to take over the entire world. He won't just stop at Kiev. He'll carry on until Poland. And then he's going to, you know, it's the same narrative over and over and over again. You know, the maniac who wants to take over the world. Fact is, Britain didn't even need to be involved in the war, and Hitler had no plans whatsoever to take France, let alone Britain.
Many of them in high places, who unwittingly, in most cases, are aiding and abetting the work of the Nazis. I do not charge these American citizens with being foreign agents. But I do charge them with doing exactly the kind of work that the dictators want done in the United States.
Exactly the same tactics now. Exactly the same tactic. Basically, this is FDR calling Lindbergh a Nazi. Same tactic. I mean, he kind of put it more politely, but he basically said, you're working for the enemy. Which is exactly the same shit that we get today when we point out the follies of the British government, and all the Tory boys do all day, every day, is accuse you of being a foreign agent. You secretly love Putin. You love the mustache man. You're a fascist, blah, blah, blah. It's the same shit, same old shit, same old shit, same playbook every single time.
Next day, America First picketed the White House. Haunted by the specter of World War I, they argued that it was happening again. America was being sucked into war.
I opposed the Lend-Lease because it gave too much power to the president, almost the power to take us into war, in spite of the Constitution. And I opposed it, and I think it had been a secret vote, it would have been defeated. but they brought some enormous pressure on some of these Democrats.
America First campaigned energetically to defeat Roosevelt. Its members besieged Congress to denounce his supporters.
Insurrection!
I was hanged in effigy in front of the Senate wing of the Capitol one afternoon by a group of women who had an effigy of me, almost life-size, all of them dressed in mourning. Moaning and groaning, calling out for pepper, that I was trying to murder their sons in war.
Where's the lie, mate? Where's the lie?
They thought that my efforts were designed to get us into a war. I was trying to explain to everybody that was the only way we could stay out of a war.
Does that mean that you...
Same bullshit over and over and over again. Yeah, the only way we could stay out of the war is by getting into the war.
You saw Britain as a sort of mercenary at that time, doing your fighting for you against Hitler.
That's exactly right. The British were in the front line of freedom.
Britain's allies took the campaign into the heart of opposition territory, Chicago and the Midwest, where America First was strongest. They found themselves fighting a ferocious battle.
I was asked to speak at an enormous rally of, I forget how many tens of thousands of people in Chicago. My wife and I were threatened anonymously with violence. Our children were threatened with kidnapping. We turned it all over to the FBI, who said they were just empty threats, but no, just trying to scare us. And they succeeded in that. We were scared to death. These isolationist people felt it wouldn't really matter if the East Coast had been invaded by the Germans and the West Coast by the Japanese. They were still 1,000 miles away from both coasts, and it really didn't matter.
The argument against helping Britain wasn't just that America might be dragged into the war. The opponents of Lend-Lease here also wondered whether perhaps Britain wasn't trying to make use of America, take it for a ride. Could she really be as poor, they argued, while she ruled a quarter of the globe? Or was she perhaps trying to use America's wealth to prop up the British Empire? Roosevelt knew that if he was going to get a major act like Lend-Lease through Congress, he'd have to persuade the American people that Britain really was in desperate straits, had run out of the gold and dollars she needed to buy her supplies. And to
coming up, by the way, yet another major Churchill cuck. Watch this now.
Convince them, he resorted to a dramatic step.
In the middle of the negotiations for Lend-Lease, the Americans suddenly said they were sending a cruiser to South Africa to collect some, I don't know what the figure was, something like £60 million worth of gold.
All right.
Which was really one of the last imperial reserves.
£60 million of gold. Yeah, why not?
This was definitely not appreciated. It gave the impression of sending the bailiffs in. And, of course, it was humiliating, but what could we do?
Gobble, gobble, Churchill. What could we do? Let's just cuck again.
We were broke. We were in these crucial negotiations with the Americans, which were going to transform the whole course of the war. So there really was no point in standing on our dignity over that one.
Roosevelt.
Yeah, so let's just cuck. No point in standing on our dignity on that one. Let's just take the humiliation again. I mean, it's if you look at the way FDR played it, FDR played an absolute blinder against Churchill at every step of the way, pretty much. And Churchill was just basically like the human embodiment of a cuckold who just takes it over and over again because he's just fixated on his absolutely suicidal mission to take out the Mustache Man at all costs, basically.
Roosevelt also insisted that Britain should be seen to give up assets in the United States. The British government ordered the Courthold Company to sell their profitable subsidiary, American Viscose, to U.S. bankers at a knockdown price.
Your people will never understand the American political system. It should be perfectly obvious to you that if Roosevelt went to the Congress and said they've run out of cash, and you had this enormous unsold property, which a lot of quite greedy Americans, no doubt.
Have you ever played Monopoly and, you land on somebody else's hotel and you can't pay up. So you have to turn over all your, you have to mortgage, you have to turn over all the properties you've got and mortgage them off and sell them at half price. That's literally what Churchill did here. Mortgaged all of Britain's holdings in America. Fucking fire sale. Come on. Take you've already taken all our gold. Now take all our property as well. Why not? And on top of that, land lease was another jolly Roger, but we'll get onto that in a second.
Perfectly willing to draw the attention of senators to. The hostile senators would make a hell of a row about it. Hard politics, the matter was, quite simply, that the land lease bill would have been endangered if the company had not been sold. Now, you take a choice, which was worth more?
See, the thing is, land lease was already a fuck. These are fucks on top of the fuck, if that makes any sense.
Only this Coast Corporation would get land lease.
On March the 11th, 1941, land lease was finally passed. Roosevelt signed the bill to give arms to Britain, payments suspended until the war was over.
Of course, Lend-Lease was the most enormous relief to anybody who was really concerned.
Remember, by the way, that if you've read Meakin's book, Stalin's War, the deal that they did with the Russians wasn't anywhere near as punitive. America just gave the Soviet Union weapons for free. No strings attached, no loan deal, nothing. Just have tanks and weapons, Joseph Stalin. You're a great dude. But Britain completely fucked over in every which way. Let's see how they took it.
And with the figures. And I don't think anybody from Churchill downwards considered at all any question of paying it back. Because Churchill had quite a simple argument on this subject. He said, well, 2 years of bloodshed ought to cancel any money.
See, a stupid attitude. And that's because Churchill, in his own life, if you know anything about him, was heavily indebted to various different people and never had any intention of paying back his debts. But of course, international governments aren't like individual charlatans like Winston Churchill, and Britain would have to pay back that money. So he was, again, completely delusional to believe that Britain could just get away with welshing on an international deal like this. What a fucking moron to think that.
Nice, Mr. Roosevelt, it's well of you. All the way you're helping us to carry on. You'll see the British Empire smiling through when at last these dark and stormy days have gone. And frankly, by the way, please convey our congratulations to the folks in USA. We're saying thanks, Mr. Roosevelt, we're proud of you. All the way you're helping us to carry on.
So let's move forward a little bit. What else happens now? Let's watch a little bit more of these talks between, because this is really going to be the theme for the next show as well, which is basically the back and forth between Churchill and Roosevelt. Let's watch a little bit from here, let's say.
One, Hitler invaded Russia. With the German army fully committed to the advance on Moscow, Britain enjoyed a brief respite. Roosevelt took advantage of the pause to invite Churchill to meet him aboard ship off the coast of Newfoundland. The night before he sailed, Churchill wrote to the Queen, confiding his hope that America would now enter the war. I do not think, he said, our friend would have asked me to go so far were he not about to take a further step.
Churchill came aboard and gave my father a very snappy naval salute, and they greeted each other very warmly, and it was almost as though electricity went between them. A great friendship sort of blossomed right from that moment. There wasn't any ifs, ands, or buts about it. He was there for the purpose of trying to persuade the president
to involve the United States as quickly as possible on the side of the Allies.
Actually go to war?
Actually go to war.
The following day, Roosevelt went aboard the Prince of Wales for a private lunch. There, Churchill tried to convince him that the time had come to declare war on Germany.
The most interesting part was the speech which the two gave. They were sitting next to each other, and it was virtually a heart-to-heart talk rather than a speech. Winston's speech was entirely, I think you'd say, emotional. He pulled every string, which he was a master at, of how the two countries got together and what times we've been through and so on and so forth.
Entirely feminine, whispering into his ear, trying to seduce him, using basically girlish tactics. It's just ridiculous.
It was a really brilliant speech, and sort of almost brought tears to our eyes. It was so brilliantly done. And I suppose, really, you can say it was the only card that he held in his hand at that time. Roosevelt's speech, on the other hand, was entirely reasoned on how his country couldn't come into the war yet. He quoted the Middle West as being a vast area with people who'd never even heard of the sea or seen it and knew nothing about Europe.
Roosevelt now offered Churchill a compromise. Although America wasn't ready to fight, she was prepared to join Britain in a declaration of common aims in the war against Hitler. The first was to liberate the countries overrun by Nazi Germany. But Roosevelt had something else in mind. Britain herself dominated large parts of the globe through her empire and its trading system. Would she play her part by relinquishing this power to create a freer world after the war?
Did you hear that? Would FDR wanted Britain to relinquish its power to create a new world after the war?
This idea was that the world was changing, that people were not going to be subjugated into colonies, and that you couldn't exploit them, that you had to work out a system whereby all people were able to have self-determination and self-development, and that we, Great Britain and the United States, should be the leaders in health.
And we still live in that completely homosexual world today. Thank you very much.
Helping them to get to this state.
But was he saying, you can't have our help unless you agree with me on this point?
No, I think he was more subtle about it than that. I think that he felt that it was inevitable that he would win with his arguments.
There's Churchill, by the way, in his quiet moment thinking, yes, I am indeed the man who gave away the British Empire. I have completely fucked my nation in all ways. Shit, how am I going to deal with this? I know. I'll write a completely self-serving history of World War II and try to make sure that that is the version that is always remembered. And then by 2024, we'll get absolute shit-stained Tory boys to repeat that story over and over and over again so that nobody ever knows the truth. Isn't that right, Winnie?
Winston Churchill disembarked from the Prince of Wales at Scapa Flow and travelled south through the Scottish hillsides to London.
So, sorry if I'm getting a bit kind of upset during this episode, but it's, I mean, really my contempt for the man couldn't be greater. I really don't see anything to admire in him at all. I just see an idiot who played himself into trouble, like a kind of really shit kind of card player who then, like, you know, have you ever seen like those poker shows where the guy's got like he's holding like a 7 and a 2, right? And you can see his hand, but he's trash talking all the other players, and he's, you know, he's trying to use like any other little bit of tactic to try to get out of the fact that he's holding a 7 and a 2. The fact is that Britain could have been holding 2 aces, right? He could have been holding 2 aces in his hand if he'd played things differently, and if he hadn't decided that he was just going to be completely belligerent, get ourselves in a war with Germany, and insist that no matter what, the only objective is to defeat and destroy the Mustache Man. That's his only sole mission. It's and look at the disaster. It has been, in my view, an absolute disaster what has happened.
He was coming back from across the Atlantic without the great prize he'd gone to win, an American declaration of war against Germany. On the other hand, he'd struck up a close friendship with Roosevelt, and he had won a promise that naval operations in the North Atlantic protecting convoys would be stepped up by America. But that was all he'd got. The responsibility of fighting this war was still on his shoulders alone. And he was going back to London to report to a British cabinet that was disturbed by some of the clauses in the Atlantic Charter that he'd signed. In particular, what looked as though it might be a commitment to give independence to Britain's colonies once the war was over.
Nice one, Winston. You've now made a commitment, a clause in this stupid fucking deal you've signed to give away all the territories of the Empire. Remember, 1927. Britain must never come under America's control. Remember, Churchill many times in his career said, my sole mission is to make sure I keep hold of the British Empire. Let us protect and defend the British Empire. I remember that one quote that he had, you know, under no circumstances will we be giving away British territories. Nice one. He basically gave it all away. All of it. And later on, when he was the Prime Minister in 1951, as we covered on a stream on a book called, what was that book called? Imperial Obituary by Richard Hilton. It tells the story of how his government in 1951 oversaw the dismantling of the entire British Empire. You know, he dies in the middle of it, but still 13 years of Tory betrayal then as well.
The dismemberment of the very British Empire that they thought they were fighting to save. But to Churchill, as he travelled south, vague promises about the future didn't matter compared with the fact that America was still firmly on Britain's side. He knew that without that, not only would there be...
You see, short-termism, short-term thinking. Whatever happens later, I'll deal with it then. It doesn't fucking matter. What matters is now. This is like a 2 chess players. FDR is thought like 20 moves ahead. 10, 20 moves ahead FDR is. Churchill's like focusing on the next move. Oh yeah, but I might be able to take that pawn. I might be able to take that. So Churchill's playing like a kind of really kind of naive materialist game. FDR's playing for position, if you want to use a chess analogy.
Be no British Empire. There'd be no Britain.
So that was the bulk of the first episode, and the second episode now shows basically in real time kind of the power of the balance of power between Churchill and FDR completely reversing. So Churchill basically has a plan, as we'll see, to be the power bottom, like, you know, I'll let FDR think he's in charge, but really I'll be kind of backseat driving. Whereas FDR is like, no, I'm the guy running the show here. And we'll see over the course of this next episode exactly how that happens. So
another night of blackout. An American voice crackled over the airwaves.
Instead of the romance of Helen Trent, sponsored by the makers of Collinos toothpaste, usually heard at this time, and instead of Argyle Sunday, sponsored by the makers of Anison, usually heard at 12:45 Eastern Standard Time, Columbia now brings you the following special broadcast.
Washington, D.C., December 26th, 1941. The United States Senate today meets with the House of Representatives to hear an address by the Prime Minister of Great Britain, Winston Churchill. Mr. Churchill has just arrived by the door roster, and he's now on the platform, and Vice President Wallace will present him. We take you now to the Speaker's platform.
Here we are, together, facing a group of mighty foes who seek our ruin. Here we are, together, defending all that to free men is dear. It is not given to us to peer into the mysteries of the future. Still I avow my hope and faith, sure and inviolate, that in the days to come, the British and American peoples will, for their own safety and for the good of all, walk together in majesty, in justice, and in peace.
What a wanker. What an absolute wanker. It's not for us to look into the mists of time. Didn't take a genius to figure out that if you mortgage off all British holdings in America, if you give away our gold, if you sign a document saying we give away the bloody empire, it didn't take bloody Nostradamus to figure out what was going to happen, Winston, did it? But no, never surrender. What a twat. I really hate this guy.
It was a moment of triumph for Winston Churchill. After 18 months of standing alone against Hitler, Britain now had, as an ally, the most powerful country in the Western world. It was almost a guarantee of ultimate victory. Until this time, Churchill had been very cautious about the way he treated the United States. He'd done nothing to upset American public opinion. He'd tried to coax from her the kind of support that Britain so desperately needed. But after Pearl Harbor, with America now firmly in the war, all that changed. Churchill was determined that Britain should, if possible, remain the senior partner, that she, though she was dependent on America, should call all the shots. In practice, though, the next 3 years was to see this remarkable alliance turned on its head.
So let's move to the. In fact, let's carry on watching this bit here because I think there are some important passages where you see the kind of maneuverings under the hood, the kind of vying for control of the Allied forces and so on. So let's watch a bit of this first bit.
And Winston Churchill looks on.
The wartime alliance, which Churchill called marriage, meant two opposite characters finding a way of working together.
They made an instinctive friendship with each other. Certainly Churchill did. And, of course, to him, the President of the United States, who was a man of supreme importance. Royalist though he was, he admitted there was one good Republican system. That was the American one.
Their modes of life were quite different. Churchill liked long conversations, and if necessary, going on late into the night. Roosevelt didn't.
My mother used to worry tremendously when they were together because Mr. Churchill would really start getting strong around 11 or 12 o'clock at night, and she would knew that Father had to go to bed very shortly thereafter.
Never before in history had two allies been so nearly united. They agreed not just to fight side by side, but to plan every detail of the war together, to keep no secrets from each other, to pool their resources as though they were one nation. The success of the plan depended on the trust of the two men at the top. But they knew from the start that however close they became, it could never quite be a partnership of equals.
This is where we get to power bottom politics. Although, as people have been pointing out, Churchill was never actually successful at being the power bottom, as Tony Blair was with George Bush, for example. He was just the bottom. He was just kind of basically a cuck.
My father felt we were aligned in a holy crusade together on the right track and for the right purpose, but he felt that we were the senior partner when it came to saying what the fabric of the world would be after the war.
Churchill always insisted that he was the junior. He was not a head of state, you see. He was a prime minister.
Again, another ridiculous Tory boy cope. Oh, yeah, because I'm a prime minister and you're a president, that means, you know, just cope. Just cope. I mean, the reason that he insisted on being the junior partner is because he needed America, because he'd moved himself from being the most powerful nation in the world to this fucking abject displays that we're seeing here.
Whereas Roosevelt was the head of the state, as well as being commander-in-chief. And so he used to defer to Churchill, to Roosevelt, a good deal. But there's no question about it that he had a much better grasp of the whole military situation than Roosevelt. And I think that we had the whip hand in the driving seat.
Churchill's worry as the United States prepared for war was that Roosevelt would succumb to political pressure and avenge Pearl Harbor, attacking Japan rather than Hitler. But Roosevelt remained firm. Germany, he assured Churchill, would be defeated first, and only then would he turn to Japan. Churchill sailed for home, relieved that he'd won the confidence of the president. Roosevelt's parting words rang in his ears, "Trust me to the bitter end."
"We have been deeply stirred."
Trust me to the bitter end, yeah.
"By his great message to us. He is welcome in our midst, now and in days to come. And we unite in wishing him a safe return to his home."
"Wish me luck as you wave."
So I'm going to move on a little bit now, because the pivotal part here is when they is when we see the kind of toing and froing over what the tactic should be. Although this fella here, I think, is funny. So we'll watch. Let's watch this fella here, because he's funny. This guy made me laugh, so we'll watch him.
"Close to neighbors, privacy is part of the pursuit of happiness. And in the sardine can called Britain, they learn to get on with their neighbors. They have to. He's too damn close. That's why they have so little crime in Britain."
This, by the way, is a completely bizarre argument. Because Britain's smaller, people have to live closer together. Because they live closer together, that's why they have lower crime rates. I don't really know how that works out, because that doesn't seem true, for example, of the people in urban America, does it? Or various other people who live in densely populated but high crime areas. So completely ridiculous argument from this film. But anyway, carry on.
"Believe it or not, even in wartime, the British cop does not carry a gun.
All those things I've seen in those fairy tale books were all there. The things I've seen in the movies were all there. And as Alice in Wonderland finally made sense with the rabbit going down the hole in the hedgerow. And we never had hedgerows around here, much less holes. I couldn't possibly see how Alice could fall for hours, but I could see once I saw those hedgerows. We were billeted in a large..."
I mean, can you imagine this guy in World War II? Like, you know, he arrives in Britain. He's there. Like, he, you know, arrives... you know, shipped over to France. Like, what the hell am I doing here? This isn't Kansas anymore. I mean, it is bizarre. Like, when you think of it that way, what the fuck is this guy doing in the middle of World War II? You know, what's it got to do with him? You know, anyway, let's carry on.
"Alice in Wonderland finally made sense with the rabbit going down the hole in the hedgerow. And we never had hedgerows around here, much less holes. I couldn't possibly see how Alice could fall for hours, but I could see once I saw those hedgerows. We were billeted in a large old English manor. We called it Pneumonia Manor. It was about the coldest place we've ever been in. And for the first time, I could realize why in all those English movies, people always walk around wearing heavy tweed coats and heavy sweaters. But I can see why you people have left England to go to America and live in dirt huts and fight Indians. Anything would be better than living in one of those garrets."
America was the mecca of all of us girls. You know, we used to think it was the most wonderful place. And we all were dying to go there. And we were all hoping to get a husband to take us there. So, I mean, you were always ready to go to a dance, you know. to go to one of their bases was absolutely fantastic because there was no shortage of anything.
Slag.
I mean, each base was...
Come on.
...was a little America with plenty of drink and food and fantastic great cakes that they made, iced cakes for these dances, and sight for sore eyes, absolutely.
We had the most money, we had the music. I think a lot of the English girls thought the Yankee was pretty... came from Hollywood. We had the films. I even told them I was from California. Hollywood, did I know Clark Gable? From next door neighbor. And it was foolish, but everybody was doing it.
So this soldier went over there. These kind of stupid British girls were like, hey, you look like those guys from the movies. Yeah, yeah, I'm from California. The things guys will say for a bit of poontang, eh?
A lot of the guys wanted to say they were from the big cities, make it sound more impressive. A lot of guys said they wanted to be from Texas. I'm a big Texan. There was a lot of the blacks that were there that said they were American Indians. there were a lot of other people who said that they were other things that they were not. I had a bad memory. I didn't make up anything because I couldn't remember who I told them I was. So I just told them the truth. I'm a Hoosier from Indiana.
Yeah, that's why he didn't get laid, that one. The first guy got laid, the second guy didn't. So that's basically the subtext there. So I want to try to get to this bit where we see the... Oh, I think it's here, where we see the disagreements over war strategy and Churchill's attempts to power bottom, you know, initially successful, but then later not. So let's watch one of the few little wins that Churchill gets. Let's have a little watch of this.
In April 1942, the American Army Chief of Staff, General Marshall, came secretly to London to discuss the future direction of the war. Here, in the underground war cabinet rooms, he put forward America's proposals. What they wanted to see, he said, was a massive cross-channel invasion of Europe in 1943, or even perhaps a bit earlier. They believed that was the way to defeat Germany. The British completely disagreed with this. They were appalled. In private, they called it castles in the air. They didn't think that there were enough troops, and they didn't think they were prepared. What they wanted was for the Allies to stick to the British strategy, to defeat Germany in North Africa, to push up through Sicily and Italy into Europe that way from the south, what Winston Churchill called the soft underbelly of Europe. But they didn't feel that at this critical moment they could afford to have a rift with their new allies. So they told them that in principle they accepted the Americans' idea, and they allowed them to leave London thinking that their plan had been accepted.
Now, when we left there, General...
So I don't know if you got that. The Americans, they wanted to enter the war from Britain, going north into France, and enter the war that way. What Churchill wanted to do was go up from North Africa and up through Italy and attack the Germans from the south, where they were less well defended. A disagreement over what the strategy should be. This is kind of interesting, this part.
Marshall said to me in the boat flying back to the United States, he said, Wedemeyer, I think the British have bought your plan. But he said, I think they did so with their tongues in their cheek. And he said, what do you think? And I said, I agree with you, sir.
American suspicions were soon justified. In June 1942, the desert fortress of Tobruk fell to Germany, an alarming defeat for Britain. Churchill faced a vote of no confidence in the House of Commons. Though he survived it, he knew he must...
Did you know that? Did you know that Churchill faced a vote of no confidence in the Commons? I'm gutted that he survived it.
...produce a military success soon, and that could only come in the deserts of North Africa. In July, he told the Americans that Britain wanted to pull out of the planned invasion of Europe. Instead, he proposed Anglo-American landings in French North Africa. The American High Command, under General Marshall, was furious,
but the president ignored them and agreed to Churchill's strategy. General Eisenhower said the decision could be the blackest day in history.
So Marshall and Eisenhower are completely against this plan, but sneaky Churchill used that defeat in Tobruk to twist the arm, basically, of the Americans to pursue his southern strategy, his soft underbelly strategy, versus the full frontal assault.
On the night of the 25th of October, 1942, Churchill's counteroffensive began with the heaviest bombardment ever mounted. For 10 days, General Montgomery wore down the German defences at El Alamein. By the 4th of November, Rommel's army was in retreat across the desert. Three days later, Anglo-American forces landed on the Atlantic coast of North Africa. It was the first time the Americans had been in action during the war. They found themselves fighting alongside the battle-scarred British, and under fire, the natural rivalries of the two armies were exposed.
Many of our troops, and most of them, had just come from the States, and already you had troops who thought that they were going to win the war. Many of them were flashing ribbons of one kind or another, had never heard a shot fired, whereas they were dealing with British troops that didn't have any ribbons, but had 2 and 3 years of experience behind them.
They were fighting for their home, and they were fighting for ours, and for Europe. I think that had a lot to do with it. But their heart was never in it.
Well, they hadn't done much. They'd been kicked out of France in 30 days once the Germans started to roll. They lost at Dunkirk. And when they tried that raid at Dieppe, that was not a win either.
You thought you were the better troops?
We knew we were.
The Allied landings in North Africa marked the first joint success of the war. Within days, the coastal cities of Casablanca and Algiers were liberated. A few weeks later...
Extremely rare Churchill win here, by the way, so let's give him his due. His little plan, his little southern underbelly strategy worked for a little bit here in North Africa.
American and British troops were jubilantly celebrating their victory over the German army. Back in Britain, church bells rang out the victory at El Alamein, a vindication, it seemed, of Churchill's conduct of the war. But the Americans were beginning to suspect that Churchill intended to keep control of the war in his own hands, ignoring his ally and fighting it his way.
We've had some grand trips, but it's been wonderful. I'm very thrilled to be here. I really have nothing new to report from the States. You know, the States, that's where Churchill lives.
Look at that, genuine heel heat for Churchill. Not well liked, was he?
Well, he doesn't exactly live there. He just goes back once in a while to deliver Mrs. Roosevelt's laundry. But he really travels, doesn't he? Boy, he's been around. He's been to Casablanca more than Humphrey Bogart.
Early in 1943, Roosevelt and Churchill and their chiefs of staff met in Casablanca to decide what to do next. The Americans were torn between an...
I mean, you can imagine, when I said Churchill is like a kind of glorified Zelensky, you can imagine a Ukrainian comedian giving the same kind of thing to the Ukrainian troops, like, where's Zelensky then? Oh, yeah, he's in Washington, he never stops traveling, he's never here, etc. I mean, it's basically the same, isn't it? Anyway, let's carry on.
Early invasion of France... or taking on Japan in the Pacific. The British were united on a plan to secure North Africa and use it as a springboard into Southern Europe.
They descended upon me. I sent a message back to Washington like locusts, the British did. They had so many more people than I. Now, here are several people here. You all have the same idea, and I present an idea, but you're all opposed to me. You offer why I shouldn't, and he doesn't, and you're all experts. That's what happened to me there. At the conclusion of the conference, I sent a message back to the War Plans Division, my division in the War Department, Veni, Vini, Vincum, and I said, I translated, we came, we saw, we were conquered.
At Casablanca, Britain's plan...
So the man in Washington got completely outgunned by the British in that little meeting there. So they continued with Churchill's strategy in this part of the war. So this is a rare moment where Churchill's kind of power bottom strategy is kind of having limited but a little bit of success here.
And prevailed. The cross-channel invasion was postponed to 1944, and Roosevelt and Churchill agreed on an Allied invasion of Sicily as the next step. The resentment of the American High Command was reinforced by the belief that the British, while wanting to defeat Hitler, would only do so by means which would restore their empire at the same time.
The main trouble in their minds was that we had much more political objectives than they had. They had one main objective, that was to beat Germany, then get back and beat Japan. They didn't understand Europe, they didn't understand the Middle East, they had no contact with all these places, you see, really. And
that hasn't changed at all, by the way, but let's carry on.
They didn't seem, to our mind, to realise that the object of fighting a war is to bring about a situation that's favourable to yourself at the end of it.
The Americans reported on the conference, Britain...
And in that aim, basically Britain failed in every single way, didn't they? I mean, it's all well and good trying to, like, you know, save the empire in the middle of this mess. Shouldn't have got in the mess at all. Completely needless, complete own goal, which is my whole argument here. But let's carry on. I think Churchill was completely delusional, by the way, trying to, like, have his cake and eat it too when it comes to this. Of course, the Americans were not going to allow Britain to use the war to shore up the empire.
Exploits the resources and peoples of other nations to ensure her position of dominance. General Wedemeyer warned that the Allies might be defeated in Europe and Asia.
So I'm going to skip forward now to when Stalin enters the war because... I think this bit is interesting as well because it shows just how much the Americans hated the idea of the British Empire and wanted it gone. Basically, let's do this bit.
It's too much, did they, Mary? But anyway, that was philosophically or psychologically right. I mean, your people weren't going to give up easily.
You think that he wanted not just to defeat Hitler and Nazism, but to maintain the British Empire at the same time?
Well, I think he'd like to maintain your lines of communication commercially. Those are important to you.
The clash over empire came to a head in India, which was now the last bastion against Japanese expansion to the West. But India was itself in the throes of a turbulent nationalist campaign for independence from Britain. In 1942, American troops were sent to reinforce the British Army in the war against Japan. They were at pains to demonstrate that they had not come to bolster Britain as a colonial power.
Should Japan decide to strike?
We Americans had a single shoulder patch which we wore on our uniforms. On it was a Star of India, Sun of China, and stripes for the United States. And everyone in the theater wore that, and that was a symbol of the fact that we were there to fight the Japanese and were not involved in the problems of the British Empire. Mr. Roosevelt had felt strongly at one time that India, for example, should emerge from the war as an independent nation. But Mr. Churchill announced that he had not become His Majesty's first minister to preside over the disintegration of the British Empire.
Well, how did that go, Winston? I mean, literally, blatantly and clearly, FDR had an agenda to disintegrate the British Empire. And Churchill's stated goal was that he was not appointed the Prime Minister to dissolve the British Empire. Who won that battle? Whose political objectives were met by the end of World War II and whose completely failed on every single front?
He felt very strongly that India was entitled to have complete self-rule. And that it was 700 million people could never be governed by a nation at the other end of the world. And I think that sometimes Churchill felt that the entire fabric...
So, you know, don't give me all this stuff that post-colonialism really is a kind of Marxist SJW doctrine that was dreamt up by some black professor at Harvard in the 1990s, please, Ben Shapiro. It's deeply ingrained in the entire American character, and especially in the doctrine of Franklin D. Roosevelt. It's literally part and parcel of the Washington mindset. So please don't tell me that anti-colonialism is some new fandangled thing. You know, which is the current crap that Douglas Murray and Ben Shapiro and so on are trying to sling, because they want to get you to support what's happening in Israel right now.
Of their relationship would break up because of this fundamental disagreement between them.
Civil disturbances in India degenerated into rioting on the streets. Roosevelt insisted that if the war effort was not to be disrupted, India must be offered independence and an interim government set up immediately. Why should Indians fight for a freedom they didn't have, it was asked. Churchill reluctantly bowed to pressure.
Churchill reluctantly cucked yet again.
The British...
I mean, it wasn't immediate, but still, you know, you can see the direction of travel here.
...government, which had, under Winston Churchill, had not been at all keen on making changes in India, decided that something had to be done. And the cabinet decided to send Sir Stafford Cripps with an offer for a form of independence.
I'm just off to India, and I'm going because I feel convinced that both the British government and the British people are anxious that I should do my utmost to try and accomplish that self-government for India, which has been so long promised.
Cripps offered independence as soon as the war was won, but the Nationalists demanded it at once and broke off negotiations. Roosevelt urged Churchill to try again, but when he threatened to resign as Prime Minister, the matter was dropped.
And there's a lot more to Indian independence than meets the eye here, which for obvious reasons they don't go into. But if you look into, again, if you go back to that stream I did on Imperial Obituary by Richard Hilton, he shows a report by Montague all the way back in 1916 saying, like, you know, there's not enough nationalist sentiment in India. We need to somehow encourage the Indians to want this freedom. And he was literally the in charge of the Raj at that time. He was our man in India, Montague. So even this was astroturfed, which is one of the more remarkable things that you'll read about in the incredibly hard to find book Imperial Obituary.
It was always believed that Churchill, from the start about the Cripps mission, had his tongue in his cheek, that he didn't really believe in it, that he hoped it would fail. When it did, in fact, fail, there was no doubt that he was greatly relieved, and his attitude was, now we've appeased the Americans, we've done our best, and now let's get on with winning the war.
While Churchill had won a political victory...
Well, James Kirkpatrick, there was a report from Montague that said that support for Indian independence at the time of that report, which you can find and read in your own time, was at less than 5%, that the most Indians just were kind of happy to carry on. So it really wasn't a very big thing. they facilitated basically the rise of Gandhi, which you can look at in your own time. He was kind of, like I've said, it's always Greta Thunberg's all the way down. They facilitated that, and Gandhi really got going with something called the Salt March in 1930, which again was given like massive media coverage and, you know, became a bit of a cause célèbre in various different places. Interestingly, it did not achieve its aims, which was to abolish a salt tax. But that is really what put Gandhi on the map, was that Salt March thing in 1930. But how can I put this? This was kind of encouraged from the inside, all of this. And again, if you read off the beaten track sources on this, like Imperial Obituary, it's all there. All the evidence is there that it was an inside job to try to get India off the books. Starting all the way back in 1916. So, you know, that Richard Hilton, basically, he concludes that between 1916 and this period that we're looking at now, virtually the entire British British ruling class was overtaken by traitors. Because that is the only way he can account for any of their actions, their stated policies, and their actual actions. Like we've seen with Churchill, his stated policy is to want to keep hold of the British Empire, but his actual actions at every step of the way result in giving it away. So let's carry on.
Over India. In Britain, America's power was visibly growing. Soldiers and airmen were pouring into the country, preparing for the invasion of France.
This is a battlefront. A battlefront like no other in the long history of mankind's wars. This is an air front.
So I want to try to get to now where Stalin comes into the war, because this is where we start seeing a real change in the relationship. So let's get to that bit. Here we go. Let's go from here, let's say.
This meeting of the big three saw the first public display of a changing relationship.
I'll go back a bit further. They have this conference in Tehran, in Iran. They neglect to mention the fact that they had invaded Iran due to Reza Shah's support of the Mustache Man. But
handle him better than the Foreign Office or the State Department. At the end of 1943, Churchill and Roosevelt flew to Tehran to confer with Stalin. This meeting of the big three.
No, Mick, this is not pre-recorded. This is live. I'm it's a live show, not a pre-record.
He hates the guts of all your top people, he told Churchill. I think I can personally handle him better than the Foreign Office.
I feel like I need to go back a bit further again. Because this bit is quite important. So see if we maybe hear.
Radically altered the relationship between Britain.
Yeah, here we go. Let's start here.
The brunt of the war was now being borne not by Britain or America, but by Russia. And the emergence of a third power radically altered the relationship between Britain and America. Ever since Hitler had invaded Russia in June 1941, the Russians had been driven back. But at the end of 1942, the German advance was finally checked in the battle for Stalingrad. Thousands of Russians died as they fought for their city house by house. On January the 31st, 1943, the German army in Stalingrad surrendered. The war in Eastern Europe went into reverse as the Germans began their long-drawn-out retreat across Europe. Russia's victory brought the defeat of Hitler closer, and meant Britain and America would have to share the fruits of victory with the Soviet Union, treating her as an equal. Roosevelt decided that in America's own interests, he should deal directly with Stalin. He hates the guts of all your top people, he told Churchill. I think I can personally handle him better than the Foreign Office or the State Department. At the end of 1943, Churchill and Roosevelt flew to Tehran to confer with Stalin. This meeting of the big three saw the first public display of a changing relationship between Britain and America.
Various jollifications took place, of course, and dinners, and the Stalingrad sword was handed over and things of that sort. But when it came down to discussions, Roosevelt had several by himself with Stalin, without Churchill, and it began to be clear to us that Roosevelt was beginning to understand that the Americans and the Russians were going to be the two great powers at the end of the war.
At the outset of the Tehran conference, it was most important for Father to not appear to be having a close relationship with Winston Churchill as against Stalin. He had to turn down Winston Churchill's approaches to have little quiet tete-a-tetes at the very beginning before the formal conference started. And
nice one. It was definitely worth going to war with a mustache man for this, wasn't it? Brilliant. Absolute blinder, Churchill.
This, I'm quite sure, hurt Mr. Churchill.
The actual fact was that increasingly, as the war went on, they paid no attention to anything we said, unless it happened to coincide with something that they wanted to do.
At the Tehran conference, Churchill was overruled by Roosevelt and Stalin. Churchill was still arguing that the next...
This is the face of a man who has been completely outplayed, completely cucked, completely humiliated, and now on top of everything else, he's being sidelined as the president of the USA cozies up to one of the most evil men ever to live. Fucking brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. That's the bulldog spirit.
The stage of the war should be to press on into southern Europe through Italy and the Balkans. Instead, the plan for a second front in northern Europe was accepted. The date was set for a cross-channel invasion, the summer of 1944. Churchill, his arguments rejected, felt himself excluded from the key decisions for the first time, and he worried that Roosevelt didn't fully understand what Russia's entry into Europe might mean.
Can you imagine? He's probably like hitting the bottle, you know, slurring his words. I can only imagine like how shit he was during some of these meetings, being sidelined and probably like slightly embarrassing. You know, Roosevelt's like, shut up, you're embarrassing me in front of Joseph. Don't embarrass me in front of Joseph. Come on now. You know, it really is fucking pathetic, this is.
Well, Tehran was, I think, the turning point in the war. The Americans and the Russians thought that Churchill's ploy was purely to protect the Balkans from the Soviet, and therefore a British imperial interest. And the two ganged up together and vetoed the Churchill proposal. Well, Churchill came back from Tehran and had a dinner in Cairo. It was in Chesterbeater's villa near the pyramids, I think. I heard him say, Oliver Cromwell was a very great man. But he made a great mistake. Obsessed with the power of Spain, he failed to observe the rise of France. Will they say this of me?
Yes, yes, they will. I will say it of you, because you're a fucking moron.
And what he meant was he'd come back from Tehran, realizing the danger which the Russians represented to Eastern Europe. He was deeply committed and passionately keen to destroy the German war machine and Hitler, the regime, but he was beginning to wake up to the question, what was going to follow?
Oh, now you wake up. You know, do you remember his speech last time? Oh, we don't look into the mists of the future. Who could have seen it coming? Only anyone with a blind bit of sense could have seen it coming.
On the 4th of June 1944, the Allies, under British command, entered Rome. The advance from North Africa and up through Italy was finally succeeding. But by now it was...
See, the thing is that people say, well, it's all well and good saying that with hindsight. People were saying it at the time. Anybody with any iota of sense of like power, geopolitics, politics at all, could see this on the horizon. I mean, all I see is somebody just completely messing things up. And, you know, I mean, there are question marks to ask about his character and his loyalties and all that sort of stuff. But even if we just kind of ignore all of that and say, like, well, let's just take him at face value as a player in this game, he is one of the worst players of this game ever. And this documentary shows it clear as crystal.
Secondary importance. For only 2 days later, the fall of Rome was eclipsed by the most dramatic act of the European War.
So let's just go get on a little bit because we now get let's get to this next space. I want to get to Yalta if I can. Okay. This was there's an interesting whole bit where they talk about how the Americans saw the war with Japan as quote unquote their war, right? They see the Japanese bit of the war. That's theirs because, of course, Pearl Harbor, that's ostensibly the reason they're involved. And I still think that you can see a bit of that in the way that the war is remembered. The Japanese bit of the war is almost completely ignored here because it's really about Britain versus Germany. But in the American imagination, they always think of the Japanese. So let's watch this little bit here.
On a cracker barrel in Montana, on a bench in San Francisco's Chinatown, the people of the USA read and listened to their invasion of Western Europe.
The invasion of the Normandy beaches was a triumph of Anglo-American cooperation. Nearly a quarter of a million men were brought ashore in 48 hours. But Churchill and his generals realized that the very scale of America's involvement in this invasion marked a turning point for Britain. 6 days after D-Day, Churchill crossed the Channel to draw attention to Britain's efforts. But he knew that once the first stage of the landings was accomplished, Britain's influence over the war would decline. She would soon find it impossible to match America in men or resources.
By that time, the Americans were undoubtedly in the driving seat. All the British Empire as a whole, when I say that, I mean the Australians, the Canadians, the New Zealanders, everybody else fighting with the British, had thrown in everything they'd got. They'd been fighting for 6 years. They were exhausted, and they'd used up every man that was available. But there was an apparently inexhaustible supply of American GIs arriving in their thousands, so that the proportions rose from something like 50-50 at the time of the landing in Normandy to, I think it was 75% American, 25% British and allies in March 1945.
As the Americans broke out of their bridgehead in Normandy and began fighting their way east towards Germany, it was obvious that they were now the superior forces in the field. With more men and better arms, it was inevitable that they, and not Britain, should now have the whip hand. "We Americans are winning the war," wrote the Chicago Tribune. "We are doing all of the fighting in the Pacific and have made virtually all the advances in France. This is an American-made victory, and the peace must be an American peace."
Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear. Nice one, Winnie. All of Europe thanks you for this. I'm sure of it.
Did Churchill find it difficult to accept America's power at that time?
No, because he had an unwavering belief in the benevolence of the United States. Churchill never ceased.
Why? Why did Churchill have an unwavering belief in the benevolence of the United States? Was he just a fucking idiot or what? Let's see what he says.
"To be a great admirer and a great truster of America. He sometimes made rather rude remarks about the Americans behind their backs. But basically, and one must remember, he was half American."
Oh, he was half American. That may explain why he had such delusional beliefs.
Basically, Churchill never lost his faith in the United States and in its intentions.
What an idiot. Just a prize clown, in my view. I'm sure that, you know, he was saying, like, in his private moments, he'd make jokes about the Americans. I wonder what the Americans in their private moments said about him. I've just got visions of, like, Winston Churchill in some of those meetings, like, falling asleep in his chair, drunk on whiskey with half a cigar hanging out his mouth. And, you know, Stalin and FDR being like, fucking hell, how do we find ourselves hanging out with this loser? That's literally what I imagine some of those meetings were like.
America's strength was not only displayed on the battlefield as the Allied troops swept through Europe, liberating towns and cities from German rule. The thoughts of the leaders of the Western world were turning to the future, wondering how to create order from the chaos they would inherit with victory. While war still raged in Europe, America and Britain took the lead in arranging a conference at the resort hotel of Bretton Woods in the mountains of New Hampshire.
Oh, this is another glorious moment in British history. Oh.
In July 1944, the finance ministers of 28 nations arrived here with their teams of economists and statisticians. They hoped to agree on laying the foundations for future prosperity. For 3 weeks, the best financial brains among the Allied powers grappled with the problems of how to create a better post-war world. They wanted to get away from the old cycle of slump and depression. They wanted to avoid the world disintegrating as it had in the 30s into rival trading blocks, each hostile to the other.
How's that working out? I mean, it worked for a while, I guess. It worked for a while. Sort of.
They had a vision of steady growth based on international cooperation. At Bretton Woods, Britain and America devised a way of ensuring stability. The international...
I mean, when the Albanian dude turns up with your Deliveroo to give you your daily slop, just remember who you have to thank for it.
Monetary fund. It would bail out economies that got into difficulties. But America had another goal here, to move the financial center of the world to the United States Treasury. The words of Henry Morgenthau, the man who headed it. As over the conduct of the war, America now used her economic strength to get her own way. Whenever there was a disagreement between Britain and America, America won. And there was ferocious argument about the scale of support the International Monetary Fund, with America as its principal backer, should provide. The leader of the British delegation, Lord Keynes, argued that Britain had lost a quarter of her national wealth and that, like most other economies, apart from America's, she'd be on her knees at the end of the war.
Just remember, Winston Churchill never lost his belief in the benevolence of the Americans. He was very trusting of them, etc., etc., etc.
Massive support, therefore, was required. But the Americans thought it wasn't necessary. The leader of the American delegation, Harry Dexter White, went so far as to say that he didn't believe Britain's plea of poverty.
We were very much afraid that in the post-war world, the United States...
Oh, yeah, Edward Bernstein. I'm sure he's got Britain's best intentions at heart.
...would be at a great disadvantage compared to the United Kingdom. White had a strange notion that Britain would come out of the war strong. It would be the only country in Europe still producing, capable of filling the gap in trade. After all, Europe is a great trading center. White was afraid Britain would develop a network of trade all over the world in which the United States couldn't enter to compete on even terms.
The debates that raged in the drawing rooms and corridors of Bretton Woods were not just about economic technicalities. but about the relative power of the United States and the British Empire. Here, Britain was at last forced to admit defeat and cede her place as the financial center of the world to the United States. Churchill accepted that Britain's day was over.
Nice one, Churchill. Brilliant. Never surrender. Apart from every single thing that every single bit of power that the country had. Just, you know, fuck all that, as long as the man with the funny mustache kills himself. Isn't that right?
He'd already written to Roosevelt about the post-war years. You will have the greatest navy in the world. You will have the greatest trade. You will have all the gold. And he ended, referring to Roosevelt's pet dog, "What do you want me to do? Stand up and beg like Fowler?"
Dark. Dark.
Churchill was to make one last attempt to restore the old relationship between Britain and America. Early in 1945, the Big Three met once more, this time at Yalta in the Crimea, to plan the shape of Europe after the war. The divisions which had surfaced at Tehran re-emerged, only sharper now as victory came in sight. Russia and the Allies, racing to occupy as much German territory as they could, were suspicious of each other's motives. Churchill feared this might be his last chance to persuade Roosevelt of the threat posed by Russia. But as at Tehran, Roosevelt kept his distance.
I was in the Livadia Palace, in a huge room, an enormous round table, and there was Stalin and Roosevelt and Churchill. By that time, of course, Churchill was under pressure, and he realized that he was very much the number three in this great array of force.
Although he shared Churchill's suspicions about Stalin, Roosevelt was still wary of Britain's intentions. 2 months earlier, he had criticized Churchill for dispatching 10,000 British troops into liberated Greece to prevent communist partisans from taking over the government.
Oh, no! Imagine if communists took over Greece. That's, you know, why does FDR always take the side of communists? That's one question that I think Americans should ask. Why in every single dispute does FDR take the side of communists? A fair question.
It confirmed his old fears.
He took the view that Churchill, in a way quite true, wanted to rebuild the British Empire, and that Roosevelt, of course, had no sympathy with imperialist and colonialist ideas.
Unless it was communist. He didn't like imperialist or colonialist ideas, unless, of course, it made the Soviet Union stronger.
But he rather forgot that Stalin had ideas which could be described as imperialist and colonialist. But he was playing up to Stalin as, we are not the imperialist and the colonialist, unlike our friend Winston here. And in fact, he more or less said it, you see, and Winston got jolly angry. And one time he got up from the table, I mean, in anger, to walk out. And it was Stalin who had to come round and say, no, we were only joking and we much admire you, etc., etc.
Can you imagine that scene of Churchill standing up in anger and it being Stalin that goes over to come to say, actually, we're just kidding, Winston, mate, you know, don't worry, you're all right and all that. Stalin, the psychopathic mass murderer, is the one who has to go over and comfort Churchill. It's just amazing.
Roosevelt had already decided that for the future of the world, it was to be the two big boys who had to settle it.
Churchill had told Roosevelt before he arrived at Yalta that the outcome of this war might be even more disappointing than the last. But, like Roosevelt, he came away believing that Stalin would keep his word and allow free elections in Russian-occupied Eastern Europe.
The Yalta Agreement wasn't bad in itself. It was the Russians afterwards who tore it up. Well,
yeah, FDR believed Stalin would run free and fair elections in Eastern Europe.
You may say that we ought to have realised they're going to do that. You may have said it was an illusion in the light of hindsight. Well, perhaps it was. But I don't think we could have done anything else at the time except try to do it. After all, in the imagination of our peoples, of the British and the Americans, Congress and Parliament, and the British Army, of course, the Russians were the heroes.
they'd won the war. They were really largely, perhaps principally responsible for beating Hitler.
Brilliant. So now they get to take over half of Europe. Nice one. So anyway, that's the tall and short of it. This was a bit of a longer one today, but I thought it was important to get through. I really think that the documentary, I don't even think the documentary, by the way, is meant to present Churchill necessarily in a bad light. I think it's just kind of analyzing how the relationship between Britain and America changes. But it, like I always say with Adam Curtis, he gives you 80% of the material and then lets you give, you know, there's the 20% gap for you to draw your own conclusions. And essentially what I'm doing is filling in those conclusions. The raw materials are all there, laid out perfectly for everybody to see. This whole series is on YouTube, by the way, if you want to watch it in your own time. We're going to be covering episodes 5 and 6 next time. So if you want to kind of follow along, I'll do the next show next Wednesday. And yeah, I'll be the next 2 or possibly even 3 episodes. Let me check my spreadsheet a second. No, the next 2 episodes. If you don't like our peaches, quit shaking under our tree and under the eagle's wing. Those are going to be the next 2 episodes. So if you want to kind of watch ahead, you know, watch the whole thing. And then obviously I break it down and do analysis on these shows. That my original conception for this series was that I would host a series of seminars where we all watch the film and then talk about it afterwards. But I couldn't figure out how to do that. And I think this format possibly works better. So let me hit some super chats and then we'll get out of here. So Lady of Shalott says, although born in Blenheim Palace, Churchill was not from a wealthy branch of the Marlborough family. His lack of cash meant he could be compromised. Indeed, and I think there are interesting parallels with Boris Johnson on that front. Spasticus Autis, and I mean, if you want to disappear down a rabbit hole, you can analyze who specifically Churchill owed cash to, and a lot of his actions make more sense when viewed from that lens, arguably. But Spasticus Autisticus says, one of the reasons Chamberlain chose appeasement was to buy Britain time to rearm. Britain was only disarmed because of the 10-year rule, a policy adopted post-World War I that assumed we wouldn't get into a big war until 1929. He continues, the 10-year rule's assumption was used to justify large cuts to the British military. It was adopted on the advice of Winston Churchill. Even more, it was extended indefinitely in 1929, again, on the urging of Winston Churchill. So there we go. What a, I mean, even Churchill prior to his big moment here was a disaster. Even Churchill in World War One is a disaster. Literally everything the guy touched turned to shit. He is the reverse Midas of history. And yet the Tory boys and the centre-right want to venerate him as the greatest British hero of all time. And there's a reason for that, because they too have reverse Midas, because everything the Tory party has touched has turned to shit all throughout our history. That's why they are the ultimate traitors to this country. And I hope they get destroyed so heavily in the next election that they're never allowed to take the reins again. Unfortunately, being a realist and knowing what the British establishment is like, that probably won't happen. They'll be back in 10 years again to fuck things up all over again. Anyway, let's continue. Not that Labour are much better, but at the very least, Labour can hold their head up and say that at certain times in history, they tried to like fight for the working man or something. All the Tories can ever talk about for their entirety of their history is selling out their own base, selling out their own stated goals in exchange for total and utter humiliation for the country. over and over and over again all through history, going right back to the repeal of the Corn Laws era, right through their entire history. They are a good party of complete and utter traitors. I really, that's one of the things I've learned since starting this channel, is just how bad the Tory party are all through history. Just scum, utter scum, a lot of them. There's not a single good Tory prime minister. Not one. Even Disraeli, I think it basically, I mean, what did he do? Like, he expanded the franchise, the one nation Toryism and all that. Spasticus Autisticus says he had the gall to criticize Chamberlain's appeasement when he was the reason it was necessary in the first place. The kind of man who would kill his parents, then beg for mercy for being an orphan. That's exactly right, Spasticus. That's exactly what Churchill was like over and over again. He's like a guy who kind of makes a mess and then uses feminine manipulation, kind of emotional tactics to try to get his way out of a hole. That's basically what Churchill is. A swindler, in other words. A swindler and a chancer. Lady of Shalott says, my great-grandparents wept when they listened to Chamberlain's World War II declaration on the wireless. After the Great War, everyone had said, never again. Yes, and that is something that, if you go back and watch episode one, which was actually on Cigar Stream last week, that's something that I cut, that the very first episode covers, which was coming out of World War One. How big the idea that never again was, you know, never again, the whole vision of Woodrow Wilson, etc. Frederick 1483 says, AA, have you ever done a Henry Ford Deepest Law? Yes, we have. In fact, I had Thomas 777 on for that episode somewhere in the Cigar Stream archives behind the paywall. John Calabro says, I've also read some of Henry Ford's naughty books as well. John Calabro says, a lot of people like to think alt history. It would be good to see an alt history if the USA stayed out of World War II. It'd be interesting. I'm also interested in the alt history of Britain just not going to war over the pledge for Poland. Would be interesting to see play out as well. Spot the Spy says, Gandhi, the first Indian PM and the founder of Pakistan, were all members of the Theosophical Lodge of London. UK theosophists inspired Gandhi to become a Hindu nationalist by his own word. Yes, the history of Gandhi is a stream all in and of itself. But he is not the character that, he's kind of like, there's a kind of a GAE, a kind of pantheon that you're encouraged to think of as heroes. Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Nelson Mandela, all of these kind of figures. None of them are really the heroes that they're painted to be, and are not quite what they seem. Mo Tooley says, what do you think of PM Pitt the Younger? Well, that would have to be, and I would have to like go back and have a look specifically at what Pitt the Younger did. It's going a bit, that's going quite a bit far back for me. All right. I think that is it, unless I've missed any super chats here. I think that's all. Let me know if you enjoy this. Maybe my tactics will draw a bigger crowd for this and I won't have to cancel the series. If it does better than 7.7, which was the last one, I'll carry it on. If it doesn't, I'll just have to conclude that people aren't interested in my Adam Curtis thing, and I'll have to drop it like I did with the Myths and Legends series. Do you remember I started the Myths and Legends and nobody watched them? Because I've only got limited time, so I have to kind of pick and choose what I concentrate on. So hopefully it will carry on going. All right, 7,700, Brent. 7,700. All right, well, do buy my courses at the Academic Agency. The Trivium is the best seller. join the channel. If you want to, I mentioned a lot of previous streams I've done. If you enter in on the third biscuit tier, which is the one which is like £4.99, £5, something like that, that is the one with the access to all of the old cigar streams. That's probably the best bang for the buck if you join on that. And yeah, you'll get quite an education if you listen to or if you watch a lot of those old streams. The one on the Weimar Republic, many of the ones I did with Thomas. There are lots of vital episodes in there. The one I did with Bap on the ordeal of civility. Lots of great stuff in the cigar stream archives. And I'll be back probably next week. There may be a stray Talking Turley that airs between now and next Monday, but I'll see you for Cigar Stream next week. Most importantly of all, ladies and gentlemen, get out.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.